At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
Welcome to New Books in Politics. I'm Jeff Bloodworth, your host. God and war. I'm not sure what could be two bigger topics. One could write whole libraries, and there are whole libraries filled with books on just those topics singularly. Ray Herbersky is not one to give himself a small task. He wanted to write about both God and war and the United States. So his book, God and War, American Civil Religion Since 1945, this is a big topic. But Professor Herbersky has done a really fine job in this book, and he is looking at the way in which Americans see themselves as religious people, especially through the crucible of three wars, meaning the Cold War, the Vietnam War, and the War on Terror. And Ray Herbersky's book has been well received by critics. I read it. I interviewed him. It's a really fine book. I hope you listen to the interview and then go out and buy the book. Ray Herbersky, how you doing?
Good, Jeff. Good. How are you?
Good, good. Welcome to New Books in Politics.
Thank you.
So, Ray, why don't you start off? Why don't you just tell us a little bit about your educational background, your biography?
Right, sure. So, I come from New York. I grew up on Long Island, and then went to high school in Woodstock, New York.
Oh, really?
And which was interesting, to say the least. You know, a Long Island kid coming up to land of hippies in mm-hmm. some ways, and good music.
Yeah.
Then I went to SUNY Albany, the State University of New York at Albany, and I did my undergraduate there in history and political science, and did a master's there in history. And it was while I was there that I played tennis all throughout college, and I met a woman who was on the Board of Regents for New York State, and she offered me an opportunity to go to Russia for as long as I wanted, basically, after I'd finished my master's. And so I took her up on it, and I went to a city called Tula, which is south of Moscow, where the Russians make samovars, and the Kalashnikov rifle actually comes from there. And I became very much sort of interested in Cold War politics and Cold War America and Cold War relations with the Russians. And I was determined at that point to probably seek out who I thought was the finest Cold War historian at the moment, John Lewis Gaddis, and try to study with him. And so I applied to Ohio University for my PhD program, and I got in. And I ended up going to Ohio University and entering into the Contemporary History Institute, just like you.
Yeah.
And that's where I met John Gaddis. And he was my professor for the first few years while I was working on my PhD. And I still think his course in the Contemporary History Institute was the single best course I've had in my life.
Wow.
What ended up happening, though, was that Gaddis was – it was pretty clear that he was going to move on. He was moving on to Yale. And by the time he was had made that decision, I had sort of shifted my focus away from Cold War diplomacy, more to U.S. intellectual history. I seemed to fit better with that particular field, and so I started to study with Charles Alexander, who had written on everything from 1920s controversies about public art and intellectuals to the Eisenhower administration.
Yeah.
And frankly, Charlie and I just clicked.
Yeah.
I found him to be just a wonderful, wonderful advisor and mentor. And He and Gaddis, no doubt, had the biggest influences on my writing.
Yeah.
So when I finished up my PhD at Ohio University, I was an intellectual historian, but I did my first book on the way that movies had changed the idea of art over the course of the 20th century and the debates about that. And then I got a job shortly after I finished my PhD at Marion University in Indianapolis, a Catholic liberal arts university. And I've been here for over 12 years. So that's sort of the short form of all that.
Yeah, and enormously, if I might add, enormously prolific. I mean, this is your fourth book?
Yeah, right.
That is that. Just talk for how do you do that with such a heavy teaching load?
Yeah, well, like you know, not easily.
Yeah.
Listen, we both went through a program that was really good on bringing who I think are really just good folks together, good graduate students together.
Yeah.
The program is designed to get you to teach well before you graduate and to get you to publish.
Yeah.
And so when I was done with my dissertation, I mean, Charlie had worked with me so well that I basically wrote an introduction and added a little to my conclusion, and that was it. The book came out.
Yeah.
So it was within my first year of being out of OU that it came out.
Hmm.
And then after that, it was, you know, it was just, I did a second book that was sort of a parallel study on a similar period.
Yeah.
I looked at sort of post 1945 movie culture in New York City and the decline of censorship.
Yeah.
And then the third one was a co-authored book with Laura Whitturn Keller on a Supreme Court case. So, and then this book, God and War, that was number four.
Yeah. Yeah. So, it's impressive. You know, it's interesting because I think a generation ago, people like you and me who taught at, you know, places that weren't research universities,
right.
They just didn't publish, you know, for whatever reason. And there are very good reasons, you know, because you want to have a life and see your family.
Yeah, right.
But, you know, what I find interesting is there's so many good books coming out, you know, being the, you know, in, you are a host now on the New Books in History Network.
Right.
That, you know, there's so many good books coming out by people who aren't at research universities.
Absolutely.
And
absolutely true.
Yeah. And you're a prototype of how it can be done. First, I really like the book, and I think I really, you know, I think this is like contemporary history at its best.
Thanks,
because
Jeff. I appreciate that.
Your cast of characters, you know, I mean, there's the, you know, maybe just talk about, I mean, I haven't looked at the archives, what archives you consulted, but I mean, you go from, you know, Reinhold Niebuhr and Jimmy Carter to Mark Hatfield. I mean, there's some, you know, the name, you know, the sort of names in there that you're like, oh yeah, I remember that person. I knew they were significant.
Right.
And you actually were writing about them. And, you know, this really is kind of like, I guess the, you know, the draft 1.5. If journalists do the first draft of history, this is draft 1.5 of, you know, Richard John Niehaus.
Right.
What kind of archives did you consult? Where did you do a lot of the research on this?
Yeah, so when I started this project, I thought that what I wanted to look at was the debate over war in the United States and how religious language played a role in that. And what I thought I was going to find initially was a very rich debate, people taking up sides in this fight. And in fact, I think not – it shouldn't have been that much of a surprise to me. It wasn't like that. What I found was that very few people who were deeply sort of embedded in their churches or their faith really took up a strong stance against American wars from World War II through to the present.
Mm-hmm.
More than that, I found was that people almost sacralized the nation as it got into a war. Because to denounce America's war effort would be to, in effect, denounce the people who were willing to kill and die for the nation.
Yeah.
And, you know, again, if anybody leads a religious congregation, you know, you're leading people. You're leading Americans. You're leading people whose sons, potentially daughters now, are going to be doing these sorts of things, sacrificing for the nation. So it's a really tricky thing to bring religion to bear against the nation. And so that's how it evolved. But there were plenty of people who tried to walk the line in between criticizing the nation and using religion to do so, and at the same time not going completely over to sort of a political theology.
Yeah.
You know, it was interesting because they had to still speak to sort of national issues, but not do it in a language that was exclusive to one church, you know? to make their case heard beyond a tiny congregation or a tiny group of supporters, which I think I don't know as much about pacifism as I do about civil religion.
Yeah.
But I think that's been one of the key problems, is that pacifism, for the most part, has been localized in particular churches and particular denominations, and even very small groups within those denominations. And it has never been received as sort of a really broad-based, very popular movement for a variety of reasons. But I think that's one of them. It's often quite exclusive to the language that people use from their churches.
Yeah. Why don't you explain a little bit about – you start off with Lincoln's bequest and sort of define – what is it we're talking about, civil religion?
Yeah, okay. So one of the things that I could not seem to get around was this concept of civil religion.
Yeah.
And it has a long history. It has a long history and somewhat of a conflicted history in U.S. academia, only because it's been so closely associated with Robert Bella, the sociologist out at University of California, Berkeley, who in 1967 came out with this very famous essay called Civil Religion in America about the ritualization of American politics, that there are rituals in American politics just like there are rituals in churches.
Yeah.
And by doing this, Americans sacralize to a certain extent their sort of political culture.
Yeah.
He focuses a lot on presidents, and not surprisingly, because they are sort of the figurehead, sort of the point that everybody can turn to, and they have the lead in many of these rituals. But what I found, what was so interesting, that while I was writing this book, a lot of other people were coming out with books about American war, in which they seemed to be incapable of getting around the idea of civil religion. So Harry Stout and George Rabble both wrote about the Civil War, and both used civil religion heavily as a lens to understand how people debated the war, how they understood it in religious terms. Again, both of them, both Stout and Rabble, show that they're not talking about religion in a very specific sense. It's not one church's language that they're using, but more of a general sense, that there's a general religious dialogue going on about war. And then, Andrew Preston came out with a great book about American foreign policy and religion.
Over
the course of the entire United States history. It's an excellent book.
Oh, that book is a tour de force.
It's incredibly comprehensive, and I think – here's a guy who is he's really opened up a lot of different streams for people to start investigating, because he took the time to sort of pick through the different ways that different religions have related to American foreign policy. But even he too, near the end of his introduction, one of the last things he leaves the reader with before they launch into this very long book about religion and American foreign policy is a small treatise on civil religion. Because it is, civil religion captures that place, that intersection point between a lot of different religions. When they have to talk about the nation, they turn to civil religion. Will Inboden did the same thing for the Cold War. So I began to think that this something's happening. Another person, John Ebel, who wrote about World War I soldiers and the use of civil religion. So I started to think that there's something to this idea that when you talk about war and the nation, that it's really hard not to consider the idea of civil religion. And so I started to read more deeply into the literature about it. And what I found really interesting, or sort of a discovery, was that Robert Bella, in that original essay, I think the reason that he comes to use civil religion, it's no mistake that he does this in the middle of the Vietnam War, that he comes to understand civil religion in America because of war. And if, for anybody who thinks in those terms about American wars and the way that people think about it as a moral debate, they almost always have to go back to Abraham Lincoln, because here's a person who dealt with the greatest catastrophe, most violent catastrophe in American history, within a nation that is steeped in religious thought, religious practice, preaching. And people, they simply turn to religion to try to figure out what to make of this catastrophe. And Lincoln, of course, as president, has to do it too. And he creates, at least in my mind, this really interesting and in some ways very difficult legacy of relating to war through God. Because he knows that people are going to do it anyway, and so we have to address it. And so my contention is that what Lincoln's bequest is in his two speeches, the Gettysburg Address and the second inaugural, he deals with the two most troubling issues when it comes to a nation going to war. The first one in the Gettysburg Address is that within war, you can find some sort of moral resolution, that the country can be made more moral, better overall in some, in a long view way through a war. It can't be fought simply because two sides can't agree on something. That war itself transforms the nation into something else, makes it into something bigger, more whole. But then in the second inaugural, I think he looks out at, you know, a war-torn nation and a population that is still calling upon God to defend its side in the conflict. And he wonders, you know, that after all the bloodshed, after all the violence, really after all the terror, would people still think that God has is playing some sort of active role in the nation? You know, could they actually claim that after all that had happened?
Yeah.
And of course he knows, yes, that's exactly what's going to happen. But he's going to call them, you know, to call the question to people. So that I see that as Lincoln's legacy for successive generations of Americans, but especially, really, American presidents and theologians who have some public role. Because I think they have to take up, you can't get around the two issues that Lincoln dealt with, you know?
Yeah, I think that's interesting, because you were saying that, you know, when you were thinking about writing this book, you were encountering other authors, you know, Andrew Preston, Harry Stout, who were taking religion seriously. And I hadn't thought about your book in this way, but it definitely is. It's part of a whole spate of books and a whole kind of generation of historians, although Harry Stout is, you know, older than you and I, who were taking religion seriously again.
Right.
I mean, it seems like for a generation, at least in the realm of sort of American foreign policy and American political history, like it used to be, you know, in your field of intellectual history, you know, the history of, you know, American religion was its own subfield, right?
That's right.
It didn't talk to other subfields. And it's now like it seems – why do you think that is? Why all of a sudden, you know, in the past 5 or 6 years, you know, I found myself reading Mark Knoll for the first time about 5 or 6 years ago. You know, and as a historian of, you know, of the United States, how could I have –
I know.
Understanding our past. Mark Knoll, I mean, is, you know, he's the top, you know, historian.
He's probably the finest religious historian we have. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah.
No doubt about it. Yeah.
In fact,
I think the thing with even with Knoll's career is interesting, because I think he's gone from being someone who dealt almost exclusively with a certain era of American evangelical Protestant history.
Yeah.
To somebody who is speaking to all of American religion. And then even more than that, he wrote this great book on the Civil War as a theological crisis. It's a brilliant book, but of course it covers all the different churches, all the different faiths. And it does so, though, through the lens of the most pivotal moment in American history. So he's become himself much broader in the audiences that he's intending to address through his topics. I think that plays a big role in it.
So can you tell me what brought you to be interested in specifically? I mean, if you're part of this sort of, you know, movement, self-conscious or not, what brought you to the study of, you know, America, trying to bring the history of, you know, sort of religion in America into, you know, the mainstream?
I've always been interested in how public debates try to get at public morality. You know, when people are trying to set limits on what they think is right and wrong or good and bad in society. So for me, it's been, you know, how do you know when something is important enough to be labeled art and therefore protected, you know, and as almost something sacred?
Yeah.
Same thing with censorship, things like that. So I've always been interested in these sort of these public debates about things that can be intensely private or intensely moral.
Yeah,
and so it's sort of a natural extension of that. Censorship debates over movies was wrapped up in religious institutions, especially the Catholic Church, for a long time. And really since my training at OU, I've been interested in Reinhold Niebuhr.
Yeah,
and his very openly public wrestling with these enormous questions, everything from the social justice of workers to the moral implications of dropping atomic weapons. I mean, very few people could write about all those different topics and do it well, like he can, like he did. And that, in a sense, too, that I think we haven't, I don't think we grappled with the legacy of war since the Vietnam War all that well until after 9/11. And then all of a sudden people thought to themselves, I mean, what have we gotten ourselves into?
Yeah.
You know, we seem to be so clear about what needs to be done after this, you know, this horrific event. Why do we think it's so easy or so clear?
Yeah.
And the writing that came after that was just amazing. The outpouring, and I saw a lot of great stuff from mm-hmm. religious historians
yeah.
and theologians.
Yeah.
One of my favorite people to read is Stanley Hauerwas, obviously. He's,
yeah.
he's a bit, he plays a big role in a couple of chapters.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, same kind of thing. I think Stanley Hauerwas is one of these guys who started out very much in sort of the mold, theological mold of Reinhold Niebuhr. But has, and while he's remained in sort of that public role of
yeah.
Reinhold Niebuhr, he is very decidedly not following Reinhold Niebuhr's theological position. He's very much a pacifist and finds his relationship to the nation to be very conflicted. And I find it endlessly fascinating, you know, to see how he negotiates in some ways his role as a public intellectual in America. And his position as a Christian first and an American a distant second.
Yeah. Yeah, there was another name that I really enjoyed. I was like, "Oh, Stanley Hauerwas. I knew this guy. I've read just a little bit, and I, you know, that's what excites me about contemporary history. Is that, you know, these
yeah.
people that, you know, I met him one time and I'm like, "Oh, I kind of know him. He doesn't know I know him."
Yeah. Yeah.
But
yeah.
that was great. So let's yeah. start off. I mean, you begin the book in the aftermath of the atomic bomb. In the mm-hmm. aftermath of World War II. Why don't you begin talking about sort of civil, what you mean by civil religion incorporated?
Yeah. Okay. So, you know, immediately after World War II and with the atomic bombing of Japan, there is a very small debate, which ends fairly quickly about the moral implications of using the atomic bomb.
Yeah.
For the most part, all the churches line up behind the righteousness, you know, the rightness mm-hmm. of doing this. But then something interesting happens. While the churches don't come out to challenge the nation, almost immediately religion grows in sort of cultural significance for lots of Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And churches begin to fill again, and there are new churches opening up. There seems to be a real need for theological perspective on the Cold War and politics in general.
Yeah.
Reinhold Niebuhr shows up on the cover of Time magazine, but I mean, he's one of many. I mean, Billy Graham is really important
yeah.
this time. There's this, you know, really a group of Catholic bishops and cardinals that become quite famous, both in local politics, but also at, you know, on the national level. Cardinal Spellman is certainly one of them. And what I saw was as the importance of religion sort of rises among Americans culturally, that they need this source of understanding of this world that seems a bit confusing and
yeah.
in the aftermath of a terrible war, it's not surprising that politicians say we should probably build on that too and
yeah.
use it in some way to relate to the people and organize them. And so what I saw, what I mean by incorporation is that I see Truman and Eisenhower, but also, you know, even just Congress in general,
yeah.
incorporating religion into the politics of the nation to affirm that the nation is a good place, that it is going to do good in the world, that the nasty things that are going to need to be done, from whatever, dropping the bomb on Japan, you know, dropping the bombs on Japan, to building more nuclear weapons, to fighting wars in Korea and elsewhere, all these things, while bad in some way, we can find something good through them.
Yeah.
You know, if we keep a sort of moral compass about us. And that's, again, it's dangerous in one sense, because by incorporating religion into the politics, there's no natural check on that use of religion.
Mm-hmm.
And so I try to bring in a few people like Niebuhr who try to call people on this, who try
yeah.
to call politicians on this. And I still think, you know, Niebuhr's Irony of American History is as relevant today as it was when he wrote it in the late 40s and early 50s.
Yeah.
Because it gets at that sort of core irony that Lincoln, I believe, was onto as well, you know, that the nation's going to fight wars. And as it got more and more powerful, those wars were going to become more and more consequential in many ways for the rest of the world. How do you deal with that? You know, a nation that's sort of designed to want to be good, to be a beacon to the rest of the world, and yet it's going around killing people, you know, or causing a lot of destruction. How do you square those two things?
Yeah.
And that's not an easy – it's not an easy public debate to have. And I think religion – this is where religion can become very interesting. Not to settle the debate. I don't, you know, I think that's one of the things that a lot of people think civil religion does, is that it simply affirms, you know, the nation's actions. I don't think so.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's this real attempt to say, listen, we do sort of generally accept that the nation, we want to be America. We want to have something good to believe in, but we also accept that we've been doing some pretty bad things. So how do we evaluate our actions? That's religion. It's how we relate to the sort of higher ideals that we'd all like to aspire to through the nation. And so I think that's where it begins. I think in many ways, Niebuhr was trying to create a check on what was happening in the 40s and the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
And that Eisenhower was one of the most brilliant practitioners of civil religion.
Yeah, I mean, I find it interesting that, you know, I was thinking about we're talking about this whole sort of spate of scholarship that's come out in the last 10 years about sort of American religion, sort of mainstreaming the history of religion in America and political and foreign policy and intellectual history. And it strikes me and also at the same time, there is this sort of revival of Niebuhr and, you know, and in parts of the American culture. And that, you know, I mean, it's obvious that it's 9/11. Right. And the war in Iraq that has brought all of this to the fore that, you know, I know my own work, I've had to contend in my own way, writing the history of humanitarian intervention with Iraq and sort of my rearview mirror and thinking, oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
You know, that sort of thing. And I mean, do you think we're kind of at that point? I mean, if the Civil War gave us Lincoln and, you know, this Lincoln's idea of civil religion and World War II is the central moment and, you know, sort of how Americans think about God and war. Is 9/11 and the war in Iraq and Afghanistan, or is this, are we at like this third kind of seminal point at this?
Yeah. I mean, I think we, in some ways, we'd like to think we are.
Yeah.
And I don't really, I think we're still in, I guess what I would say is that we're still using the language and the metaphors and sort of almost the analysis that we apply to World War II
and the
Cold War
to
understand what we're doing now.
Yeah.
So I don't see a real great sea change.
Yeah.
And I think guys like Hauerwas really wanted it. I really wanted the last few years to be a time of accounting for this stuff. Jim Wallace, I think, who I'm sort of ambivalent about in some ways. I think he also saw it in those terms. He really wanted people to consider, well, what are they supporting and why? And what are the sources of allegiance do they have? And what are the sources of moral analysis can they call upon? I don't think it has been that. I mean, you know, I think the drone policies also bring up some interesting questions about just war.
Yeah.
So it's really open. I actually think right now, in some ways, it's great for scholars who are interested in using religion, because there's so much interesting debate out there right now, and you know, just war theory has become a really interesting topic yet again.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I guess if this were a seminal, we wouldn't be sort of still relying on Niebuhr. We might have our own Niebuhr.
I think that's a real problem in some ways. Yeah.
Yeah.
Often we sort of use Niebuhr in a way that doesn't leave him to his own era, where he was. That's what he was writing about. That's what he was influenced by. And while he may ask questions that we can apply, we've got to do some more heavy lifting now, and not just, you know, wring our hands and say, "Well, we're all Niebuhrian." You know, bad things must be done in order for good things to happen. I mean, it's such an awful simplification of Niebuhr's thought.
Yeah, no, you're right. It is. It's sort of that's enough. You know, to sort of go, well, you know, Niebuhr would say this, and isn't that awful? But, you know, I'm a realist at the end of the day, you know, but a tragic realist, and there we go, I think about it.
Right, right.
Oh, man.
In the middle of the Cold War, you can understand, to a certain extent, being a tragic realist, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, no. You've, man, Ray, you're making me think. I had my pat answer. I just, you know, I had that memorized in my head. And now I think you're right. You move on into the 1960s and you're talking about John Kennedy. And talk about Vietnam and its role in sort of shaping a civil religion.
Yeah, so this chapter was interesting because in some ways, Vietnam is, of course, a great example of failure.
Yeah.
Yet at the same time, it's not so simple. And I think this is where Bella's interesting because unlike I don't use Bella as a sociologist, as a religion. I use him as an historical actor.
Yeah.
You know, he comes to terms with civil religion because he finds Vietnam shaking the very foundations of the idealism, ideology that Americans had trusted was there.
Yeah.
And the person who no doubt, you know, exemplifies this, who wrestles with this more than anybody else, is Martin Luther King.
Mm-hmm.
King uses our better angels, basically, to get people to think about race relations in the United States
yeah.
and the expansion of civil liberties. And then he has to, in 1967, think about the Vietnam War really for the first time. You know, he's 66, 67, he's beginning to turn towards a new stage in his political thinking, and he has to turn his argument against itself in some ways. He's
yeah.
saying that if this war continues, it will undermine the nation and all that it stands for, this war. And even though it has nothing to do in some ways with race relations or with social justice, the United States, I guess, conceivably could have picked up from Vietnam and left. But he knows that the way that people are not reacting to the war is incredibly troubling.
Yeah.
And he's wondering if this is not, in fact, a bigger problem than race in America.
Hmm.
You know, that the killing of thousands and thousands of people, thousands of miles away, seems not to really affect people very much.
You know? Yeah.
And it certainly doesn't seem to give the government any pause or any real reason to justify all the violence. So for him, it's incredibly disturbing. But then, near the end of the chapter, I flip to Newhouse, Richard John Newhouse, who,
yeah.
although he becomes a Catholic in the very early 90s, he was a Lutheran minister, young Lutheran minister in the 1970s, and was King's contact in New York City. He marched with King when King came to New York. And he was very much anti-war, anti-Vietnam War. But by the near the end of the war, Newhouse writes this fascinating article about the churches and the Vietnam War. And he says, we have to be real careful. While the church leaders in the United States may have come to the conclusion the war was wrong and bad, their parishioners, their congregations have not. And, we should be very, basically saying to his fellow church leaders, be very careful how you talk about what to do next. This is not the time to say that, you're going to bring the wrath of God down upon the United States as if it is a person.
Yeah.
Don't moralize the nation into an individual. It doesn't operate in that way.
Yeah.
But your parishioners, your congregation is going to think that you are doing that if you condemn the nation, categorically. And it's fascinating because what he's basically doing, Newhouse, before it happens, he understands that there's a culture war brewing over the legacy of the Vietnam War and war in general in the United States. And Newhouse with a lot of things, but I think he was really, really bright when it came to contemporary politics.
Yeah, this was the Richard John Newhouse I didn't recognize. I had no idea about his I read him in First Things or New Criterion.
Right. Yeah,
I knew him in the 2000s, and I had no idea he cut his teeth marching with King.
Right. But, it's like so many of the new left, the neocons, which is a bad label for some of these folks. But like a lot of neocons, he was one of these guys who had marched against, racism, war,
and then
turned around and at some point decided that was the wrong way to go for a variety of reasons.
Yeah. No.
I think top among them, he felt that people who had come out of the Vietnam War against the nation had gone too far. And that's a very interesting thing to study because it's not so simple. It's not simply they became, they became anti-American. It's a very interesting dance. It's academic, it's scholarly, it's theological, it's all these things. And the culture wars, among my colleagues we do the Society for U.S. Intellectual History, many of us think that the culture wars will become sort of like progressivism or pragmatism, to this generation of scholars. It will be one of those organizing tools for the historiography, So that's really where the rest of the book sets out, to talk about civil religion in relation in many ways to the culture wars.
You did a nice job of, I mean, speaking of neocons, I believe you called them the new neocons, actually, which is, I thought, right. The best way of talking about them. And I know I'm skipping ahead, but I liked how you kind of made the difference between the neocons of the 70s and the neocons of the 2000s. Do you just want to talk about that just briefly?
Yeah. So what you get is a different breed of neocon in, let's just say, like the sort of the Bush era.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, where the optimism overwhelms whatever pessimism had been with the older neocons.
Yeah, yeah.
And that, again, is really for people who had read Niebuhr and thought that they were like Niebuhr as a neocon. These new neocons were so naive.
Yeah.
You know, to think that they could walk into other countries and convince them by mortar fire that the United States was doing good.
Yeah.
You know, that it's just, it was just crazy. But at the same time, it wasn't like there was a great alternative, and they understood in many ways. The old neocons understood that the new neocons were using their moment to take full, you know, sort of full advantage of the moment to make the nation into something what they all thought it needed to go into a better direction. It needed to go beyond the Clinton era. It needed to be to affirm some sort of romanticized version of an older America. And maybe, just maybe, you know, Afghanistan and Iraq would have been those events to do it. But again, the old neocons, I think many of them also thought, but there's always that possibility that we're basically supporting a disaster. And of course, you know, for the most part, that's what begins to happen. And I see Newhouse, he's really one of the central subjects of a book that I'm working on now.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm.
But Newhouse's arc is fascinating. He's very supportive of the first Gulf War, of Bush's wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. But by near the end of his life, and near the end of Bush's administration, he is really sort of distraught over how badly things have gone. And he's, you know, I don't know how. I mean, I haven't really gotten into the most contemporary stuff. I haven't really interviewed many of his colleagues yet.
Yeah.
But I have a feeling that he was, you know, questioning his own logic behind supporting Bush early on. Yeah.
Well, I know I skipped ahead. I mean, but let's just go back a little bit. I apologize.
Sure.
But talking about Reagan and Carter, I think that made a lot of sense, putting those two together, talking about civil religion reborn.
Yeah.
I just want to talk about Vietnam and its relation to especially Ronald Reagan.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, so Reagan is no fool. He knows that it's sort of a third rail, right? In trying to talk about an American legacy, how do you talk about Vietnam? For Carter, he's just going to say, "Yeah, it was awful," and so let's learn our lesson, never do that again.
Yeah.
And Reagan is saying, "Well, wait a minute. Not everybody thinks that.
And
it's not a simple lesson. And so how do we move forward?" Now Reagan understands that there are plenty of people who find meaning through sacrifice for the nation.
Yeah.
You know, for them, there is nothing greater than that. Now, if you discount, you dismiss all those people by denouncing the Vietnam War and finding one lesson in it, that's what he saw Carter doing. So it was very easy for Reagan to say, well, he's soft on this and soft on that, even though Carter really wasn't in foreign policy terms. But I think rhetorically, it was very easy for Reagan to use it as a weapon against Carter. But I also think that Reagan understood that if he used the sort of civil religious rhetoric well, it gave him some room to maneuver beneath it. You know, he was no great fan of fighting wars that could not be won very easily and at a very little cost.
Mm-hmm.
So, do we go to war during Reagan's time? The Americans? Not really.
Yeah.
You know, he certainly supports lots of people killing other people, but there are not many Americans dying during his administrations. You know, and when they do die, like he pulls out of Lebanon very quickly after the Marine barracks are bombed. And, all of Central America it's a terrible situation, but he's basically letting everybody else deal with that. He's not really the one to talk about it. What he likes to talk about is ending the Cold War and doing away with all nuclear weapons. I mean,
yeah.
The second term is basically monopolized by that.
Yeah.
It's extraordinary, you know?
Yeah.
Where a lot of the neocons he's leaving behind. He's leaving behind most evangelicals who had voted for him, who had this almost apocalyptic, you know, version of mutually assured destruction, you know?
Yeah, it was supposed to have a nuclear war, which would bring Jesus back, and everything would be better.
Right. I mean, well, at the very if that's what it takes, okay.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
But we're not going to get. You know, we're not going to brook any compromise with the Antichrist, with the Soviets.
Yeah.
So you know, and we're certainly not going to use terms like détente and things like that. You know, so Reagan just jumps over everybody and says, "Oh, that's fine. All right. Well, I'll just call them what they are. They're evil, but also say that they've lost. It's over." And I think nobody really expected that to happen. Like, nobody expected a president like Reagan to say, yeah, well, I mean, the Cold War is won, and it's won by us. So now what did both sides say? So you have everybody who's been opposed to the nuclear, to increase the nuclear weapons saying, oh, well, now what is our position if the president of the United States is declaring the Cold War over? And you have on the other side all the neocons and hawks saying, well, this is what we wanted all along. We wanted to win the Cold War. So Reagan has it on both sides. He's won. He's beaten both sides in many ways. Fascinating.
Yeah, and so, you know, at the end of the Cold War, you know, this is where you kind of move into what you call civil religion at bay. And, I mean, this is where you get into the neocons and George H.W. Bush. Do you want to talk about how sort of early post-Cold War era, how this fits in?
Yeah. Yeah, sure. So, you know,
I really enjoyed this chapter. This was
good.
This chapter was awesome. It really was.
Good. Yeah. I mean, George H.W. Bush, more stuff needs to be written about him. He's a very interesting guy.
Yeah.
And to me, he's this interesting character whose life had been defined by war. I mean, you know, he goes into World War II. He volunteers right out of high school. And for the most part, he gives his life over to the nation and in some sort of military capacity, you know, whether he's fighting or he's head of the CIA or he's watching, you know, the Cold War unfold from various positions in government. And then here he is after the war is over. War as an organizing principle is gone from a guy who only knew war, basically, as an adult. And so I think he has some crisis of – I would say a crisis of definition, crisis of identity in a sense.
Yeah.
And when he goes into the first Persian Gulf War, I mean, he's using the logic that would have been very accepted in World War II, or at least would have sounded familiar to those who believe that World War II was a completely good war.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he's wrestling with religious advisors who are saying, you can't do this. Is it really necessary to send tens of thousands of troops in there? And then he's saying, well, listen, there are moral atrocities going on in there. Who's going to come to the people's aid? You know, it's up to the United States. We are the beacon, you know, and sometimes you have to be powerful to stop great moral tragedy. And so, you know, this is his feeling. And of course, he's backed up by probably the greatest coalition since World War II, you know, of countries.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, he's a one-term president, so he falls off the cliff.
Yeah.
You know, the war goes really well, but really quickly. Nobody in the United States is really all that interested, actually much like after World War II, in thinking about their relationship to the country through the military, you know, I mean, they're pretty tired of war.
Yeah.
And so instead of real war, you get the culture wars.
Yeah.
You know, they're sort of the substitute for that. And people are trying to figure out how to define the United States as a single entity. And while they're doing that, they're ripping it apart. So there are all these different factions that are trying to define what is the most important term to identify with the United States, what is the most important source of American identity, you know, what should be sort of the fundamental question, you know, the first question. And of course, that's where first things comes from.
Exactly.
Out of that crisis that they say, listen, there are first principles that we all should understand. And that was just, another player in the culture wars.
I mean, and this is where, you know,
go ahead.
This is where, you know, your new neocons come to the fore. And I loved it. You kind of talk about the Kagan and Crystal essay toward a neo-Reaganite foreign policy, which I remember reading as an undergrad. I still remember reading this article. And, you know, tell us about why this is such a central article and, you know, and sort of how this sets the stage for the 2000s.
Yeah, I mean, I was the same way. I remembered reading it and thinking to myself, what they're trying to do is reclaim sort of Reagan's thunder and how he fought the Cold War. But when I reread it, I realized what they were asking for was not Reagan, but almost like an older version of a militaristic America that I don't think ever actually existed. You know?
Yeah.
And it was this sort of strange interpretation of what World War II did to the American soul. You know, it sort of steeled it for the Great Cold War. That Americans won. Of course, nobody after World War II felt that way, and nobody after World War II thought that the Cold War was ever going to be over.
Yeah.
And so, so these guys come to the conclusion is what really what we need is a more military-minded public. They have to understand the sort of sacrifices that are absolutely necessary to have a great nation, have a nation that's worth investing in, dying for, killing for. Listen, at the end of the essay, they're pretty much calling for some sort of grand military conflict. You know, what we need is war.
Yeah.
You know, to make it clear what it is that's most important in life. Now, did they, you know, seek out to manufacture a war just for the hell of it? No.
Yeah.
I think they, like a lot of those new neocons, they were incredibly optimistic about what the United States, what its power, its unmatched power at that time was capable of doing, you know? And sure, I mean, if the United States went around the world and just sort of, with its a magic wand of missiles, turned things into democracies, turned countries into democracies, it really would have been sort of a historical moment that was completely unprecedented, you know? Never before had a revolutionary force been matched with such a powerful military force, but we know that didn't happen. So
it's this combination of sort of the economic might of the United States in the 1990s and these seemingly, you know, at least from afar on CNN, you know, the successes of the Balkan Wars and Kosovo.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, well, American military can do good things. Humanitarian intervention's awesome.
And then, of course, it has to. That's the question, right? I mean, it's not just that it does good things. It has to do good things, you know? It's sort of incumbent upon the United States to do these good things.
Yeah.
You know,
meets foreign policy crisis called 9/11, a coherent set of ideas tailor-made to hand over to fit a particular crisis. And that's the thing that I've been, you know, I kind of dabble in the history of humanitarian intervention, and I was a staunch advocate, and then I look back and like how drunk the liberal hawks were, and I call myself a liberal hawk, and I think without the liberal hawks backing the war in Iraq, maybe I fool myself, but I think the war in Iraq would have been a heck of a lot more difficult to wage without having cover from the political left. But do you just want to talk about civil religion forsaken and how in this book?
So I end it probably predictably, saying that what 9/11 does is that it exposes, again, the sort of paradoxes of a religion, because the country needed some way to talk about itself being, the promise of the world or somehow good after 9/11 because it had just been attacked. I mean, it would have been stupid not to have that sense. And of course, many people, many preachers, many religious leaders are coming together. That, the National Cathedral speech that Bush gave was sort of this shining moment of that. But then, you read somebody like Susan Sontag, and she says, sure, let's all mourn together. Let's not be stupid together, And I think that's where civil religion is indeed forsaken. We had probably the greatest outpouring of goodwill towards the United States in its history.
Yeah.
And what did we do? We attacked a country, we attacked Iraq in such a way that we made sure that coalition would fall apart. At this point, is anybody defending that we went in with the right plan, that we knew how to react, to the disaster would follow? But even more than that, you can see it as there's this transition moment after the attacks in Afghanistan begin, which are fairly limited, very quickly. It's a fairly circumscribed war, And, Kabul is liberated, girls are going back to school. It's really, in some ways, a very good feel-good story within the first 12 months.
Yeah.
But then you get the build-up to the Iraq War, and the language changes. It's all of a sudden, it goes from America's been attacked to America needs to create, change in the Middle East, and this is the way to do it, that Saddam Hussein is simply a threat, an existential threat to freedom around the world. It's so disconnected from how most Americans and most people around the world had viewed the United States immediately after 9/11. And there was no attempt to sort of, bridge the gulf between the two. And I mean, that's where you start to get this real great disconnection between some of the religious leaders who were still supportive of the country after 9/11 and those who are beginning to dissent from, break away from what the nation is doing in Iraq. And I use, you know, Newhouse and Harawas again to sort of talk about this, because it's the debate is pretty much the same as it was over the first Gulf War. And that's important to realize that the terms have been there all along, you know, how we talk about these things.
And so is this kind of one of your kind of larger themes that you want to sort of address, kind of what Martin Luther King was talking about, that, you know, the moral crisis of Vietnam is sort of our moral crisis today, a state of semi-permanent war,
right.
Drone strikes where, you know, thousands of civilians are either killed or injured across.
Right.
And
right.
Americans, even on the political left, are generally sort of like, okay, yeah.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I mean, how do we talk about it? You know, how do you deal with it? Do listen, if they care, fine. I mean, then America should get ready to reap what it's sowing then, you know? But if we keep sort of wringing our hands every once in a while about these strikes or about war itself and that it doesn't, that the United States is better than its actions, well, what the heck does that mean? You know, as a historian, right?
Yeah.
What I'm interested in is how people construct their arguments about difficult subjects. You know,
yeah.
That never is it very simple what the solution is.
Yeah.
But how do we go about doing it? And what are the patterns? What are the trends? Who gets to speak? And how are certain views incorporated into official policy? When do official policies change?
Yeah.
Carter was different than Nixon and Johnson. Why? You know, Reagan was different than Carter. You know, what did Reagan learn in some ways from Carter?
Yeah.
Why did Bush do what he did? Even though, you know, the sort of neo-Reaganite foreign policy that he wanted to adopt, it was really a strange interpretation of what Reagan had actually done during
yeah.
the administration. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So I'm interested in that kind of stuff.
I'm sorry? Yeah, you're interested in that kind of stuff.
Yeah, that's what I'm interested in. Yeah.
Yeah, that's, I really appreciate this book because it, you know, I've been thinking lately about the drone strikes and, you know,
yeah.
just how, you know, this has been in the news lately. And I mean, you've made me realize I'm far too blasé, you know, that at the very least, what are our questions? That we're not contending with this, that at the very least, if we're okay with it, we need to somehow be, the path to being okay with it needs to be tortured if you're okay with it.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Right.
And it's just, we're far too satisfied. It seems to me. Does that kind of, am I saying anything?
And
close?
You know, and the thing is, oftentimes we're far too okay with it because we use sort of religious arguments to cover up the difficult parts, the difficult questions. You know, that well, it's God's will, or well, you know, bad things happen to good people, and that's simply, you know, and sometimes good people have to do bad things. That's you know, these are questions I think that Lincoln had to take head on. You know, in a country that was ripped apart by war and yet that was interpreting that war through the religion. And he was trying to say, think about how you are using your religion. I mean, are you really prepared for the implications or the weakness of your argument? You know, at least think about it. And I think that's where Harawas often is, you know. He often says, he and I have been corresponding about this, and you know, he says, you know, Americans have plenty of faith. Why do they need civil religion? And he's absolutely right about that. That's his greatest greatest contribution to hammering civil religion. He says, yeah, it exists in some bizarre way. It's certainly not a legitimate faith. But my God, why don't Americans use the faith they've got to keep themselves out of using or relying on civil religion to seemingly justify a lot of these terrible things?
Oh, interesting.
Or to get away from the questions about them, you know?
Wow, the irony of the most devout, developed country in the world not using its actual spiritual religion when confronting the questions in which one would argue you would need religion the most.
That's right.
Well, this book made me think.
Great.
You mentioned, what's your next project, Ray? Is it Richard John Newhouse?
Yeah, it's going to be sort of a collective intellectual biography of Catholics in war and peace. So more or less from the just before Vatican II through to the present.
Oh man!
And I'm looking at sort of the transition that the Catholic Church underwent during those years from being, you know, quite a bit on board with, you know, the United States government's military policy and wars, and then being very critical of it by the 1970s and 80s, and then coming back to being much more supportive of it by the 90s and 2000s. So I'm interested, you know, it's one of those gaps, I think, that would be, it needs to be filled. And it definitely raises some fascinating questions about how people use faith in a time of war.
Huh. So, wow. You're going to have a really interesting cast of characters. What, Michael Novak?
Yes.
Newhouse.
Yeah, exactly.
Arrington.
George Weigel, Newhouse. Yeah. I mean, from Murray on up, basically. John Courtney Murray on up.
Oh,
and all the bishops. Yeah. Bernadine in Chicago.
Oh, yeah.
O'Connor in New York. I mean, O'Connor's a really interesting person that very little good has been written about yet because, it's somewhat new. You know?
Yeah. Now, he was very interesting. He was such a towering political figure in the 1980s. And it seems like, you know, we don't have a bishop in the U.S. who behaves in a similar fashion today.
Right.
Yeah, wow. Okay, well, all right. Well, I already got you booked for the next book, okay? And the way you write, this will be out in 6 months. So...
I wish. Yeah. But I do have one coming out in about sometime, probably next year, on Franciscans. I teach in Franciscan school. Franciscans and media in basically 20th century America. It's been really interesting to do this. It's a smaller book. It's about 125 pages or so.
Uh-huh.
So it's been really interesting to do. So it's been a pleasure.
Wow. Well, Ray, thank you very much.
Jeff, thank you.
American Civil Religion Since 1945 by Rutgers Press. Go out, read it. Well, hold on first. Buy it, then read it, and then tell your friends. Okay. Have a good day, Ray.
Thanks a lot, Jeff.
Uh-huh. Bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Well, I hope you enjoyed my interview with Ray Hiberski, and you are so inclined to go out and buy his book. And tune in next time on New Books in Politics, where we talk to an author about, just as the title says, a new book in politics.